right. Good morning, everyone. If you guys need Bibles, there are some Bibles in the back. You guys just raise your hands, and then people will come around to give you a Bible. So if you guys need one, raise your hand, and we should be good to go. We'll have a few passages we're looking at today. No one? Sweet. Okay. All right. So my name is Christian. It feels weird to introduce myself every time because I've been a part of this church community for like 6-7 years now, and hopefully everyone knows me. But I also like don't have a title. Like, I'm not like leader of anything. I'm just a member that enjoys reading the word and studying it. About like a week and a half ago, we had just gotten done with a meeting to plan perspectives. And I get home and I get a text from Brandon, and it's really late. So I'm like, oh goodness, like, what is this? And he's like, hey, do you have time to, or would you be willing to teach a few Sundays from now? And then he was like, it's a week and a half. And I was like, and usually like what I'll do is like, you know, like go and pray and be like, Lord, what should I do? And for some reason, I was just like, sure, why not? And I was like up last night, and I was like, what did I get myself into? And typically it's also like helpful when he gives me like a topic, because it's like, all right, like I don't have to spend time thinking about what I'm going to teach. I can just teach on what he wants me to do. And like, I can kind of like zero in on what's going on. And he was like, so I was like, do you want me to teach on anything? Like, are we in Leviticus or what do you want me to do? And he's like, something simple. I was like, okay, nice. So if you know me, that's probably the worst thing you could say to me, because I overcomplicate everything, and it's just something that I deal with. And so we are going to be talking about Mark 8 today, and it's this particular chapter is something that I have been gravitating towards recently, because a few years ago, and when I was still part of the Well, that sort of college community, we had like gone like verse through the whole book of Mark, and it was really fun, and there was like a lot of like fun discussions and like a lot of questions. And so like what would happen is I would be like, all right guys, we're gonna go through like Mark 1 and 2. And the first meeting, we get through like the first 5 verses, and I'm like, I think this is what's going to happen every week from here on out. So we took 6 months to go through the whole book of Mark, but it was really beautiful. And I think going through it as a whole, there was like a lot to do in Mark with structure narratively. And what's unique about Mark is that one, like, it's not explicitly stated that Mark is the writer. So you know, when Paul is writing a letter, he's like, oh, I am the Apostle Paul, appointed by God. And for Mark, he doesn't open like that. And we'll get to the first line here in a bit. But we don't know exactly who wrote Mark. A lot of people think it was John Mark, who was following Peter around. And so another interesting thing is Mark is not one of the 12 disciples. He's just following Peter around, and he's listening to Peter, and Peter has all these, you know, great stories, and there's these sermons, and so, like, you can imagine, like, Mark is just, like, writing these down, and he's like, oh, like, that's really good, oh, that's really good, and then, like, eventually, he compiles all of these stories into the book that we call Mark, and what's also fascinating is that for, you know, hundreds of years, people thought Mark was written after Matthew and Luke. And so people kind of like saw Mark as this, you know, Spark Notes version of, you know, Jesus's life. And it wasn't until like the 9th century that people started to reconsider that. And it's now thought that Mark is the earliest written gospels of all the gospels. And so you'd imagine like all of these people who didn't really pay attention to Mark, and now they're having to like rethink how they view this gospel. There's like a lot of really fascinating stuff in the book itself. But as a church, we've been going through, like 2 weeks ago, Brandon talked about like discipleship and the Great Commission and like how we ought to view spiritual disciplines. And last week, Todd talked about evangelism and how do we, you know, cultivate a life of sharing the gospel routinely, and how is Jesus' mission about that, about preaching the good news to all the world. And so I think Mark 8 is kind of blends into all of those areas because narratively, what's going on in Mark is the kind of like structure of it is like Mark 8 being the middle part of Mark, it's in some ways like the pivot point where Jesus is he's talking to all of these like Gentiles and he talks to some Jews, and that right at this point, he no longer is trying to keep his, you know, Messiahship title. He's not trying to keep that closed. Before, he's telling everyone, like, when he heals someone that's possessed, he's like, hey, don't tell anyone, you know, keep it quiet. And you're like, why is he doing that? And then he does this over and over and over again. And then you get to Mark 8, and instead of, like, what's unique also is typically rabbis had these followers, and the followers would ask the rabbis questions. But Jesus is not like the other rabbis. He inverts that, and he asks Peter a question instead of Peter being the one to ask him a question. And he asks him, who do you say I am? And he says, you're the Messiah. And then after that, he explains what it means to be the Son of God. And then they go. They start making their way to Jerusalem. And from the Sea of Galilee to Jerusalem, it's probably about like a week's worth journey of walking. And so it's quite a bit of ways that they're going to have to go over there. And so there is, in some ways, a lot to go through and like sort of wrap your mind around. But in a lot of ways, Mark 8 is like self-explanatory. And before we actually get in there, I'll pray, and then we can start getting into Mark. Father, thank you so much for your word, Lord, and thank you for preserving it. Thank you for sending your son, Lord, and yeah, we look to Jesus as the pioneer of our faith, the one who loved us and gave himself for us, Lord. And we come here to learn how to follow you and how to obey all of these things you've commanded us. And we just ask that your spirit would teach us and you would provide insight into these words that Jesus, you had for your disciples and for all these people that were following you, Lord. And yeah, we thank you for this morning and a time to just meditate on your words and a time to just reconsider some of these words that you had said. In your name I pray. Amen. Cool. So, as we're going into Mark, something that's also unique, there's a ton of unique things about it, but one of the coolest parts is there's this thing called the like a Mark sandwich. And what happens is he's like following the story and he's like going, he's telling what's going on. And then you get like a short paragraph and it's like, he heals this person or he does this. And what Mark is doing is like, he's consolidating all of these stories. He's consolidating all of the things that he's heard from Peter. And he chooses to put this little, insert this small story to give you insight as to what's actually going on. And this happens like 8 or 9 times in the whole book of Mark, but it's really unique. And so like as we get to Mark 8, you're also going to see that in Mark 8, there is a Mark sandwich that gives us insight as to what's going on. And I think the biggest reason why I wanted to talk about this, though, is because it's helping us reshape our view of Jesus. And Mark, he talks about Jesus in the most human aspects, right? So like in Matthew, it's about like, how is Jesus fulfilling the Old Testament? And like, how does he fit into the whole story of the Bible and what prophecies are going on? But in Mark, Jesus is very, very human. He's someone that we can relate to. He gets angry. He gets sad. He has compassion. He has all of these things like are wrapped up into this one person as he gets unfolded into us. And so, with all that said, let's just read Mark 1. Mark 1, verse 1. Let you guys a second to get there. And we're not going to spend a ton of time in Mark, but think it's fitting and it's helpful just to see the beginning. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Okay, so unlike other gospels, Mark skips the whole Jesus birth thing. He doesn't give you that story. He is like, the point is to tell you about the kingdom of God and how Jesus is the fulfillment of the good news. Like, in one hand, Jesus is preaching the gospel, but in another hand, like, Jesus is the good news. Like, he's the fulfillment and the culmination of the whole story of the Bible. And so it's weird. He uses the word the beginning of the gospel. I won't make you guys show your hands, but if in your head, like, if you think about, like, what is the gospel, what is the good news, like, how many of you think of time frames? You don't think of time periods. You think of maybe a statement. You think of these five tenets, right? That, like, Jesus came, like, we were sinners, and Jesus came into this world, and he died for us, and then we're going to go to heaven, right? That's, like, the basic, probably the basic summary that you would give people if they asked you, what is the good news? But Mark doesn't quite do that. He says, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So on one hand, I think how he sees the good news is not necessarily, it's not that it doesn't include all of those points, but I think the way in which he sees the good news unfolding is very unique. Two, it's the good news of Jesus Christ. So we kind of glance over those words and we're like, all right, that's cool. I've heard this 1,000 times. Like, Jesus Christ, yes, we follow him, and he's a good person and a teacher, and he died for me and all these things. But, like, the Christ part is, like, really, really, really important. Like, because this is talking about the Messiah. It's talking about the one who is going to save Israel, the one who's going to be anointed, right? And he's going to do all these beautiful things. And so Mark is like, okay, this is the good news of the Messiah, the person that is supposed to come into the world and save it and rule and reign over Israel and fulfill all of these sorts of promises. And then the last part of the verse is, he's the Son of God. And then you're like, all right, like, what does that mean? And what other parts of the Bible talk about the Son of God? And why is this important? And in the first verse, you get that we're being plugged into a story. This is about the Messiah. It's about the one who is going to suffer. And it's about the one who is going to reign and rule. And he just so happens to be the Son of God, if that's not already confusing to you. And so in this first verse, there's, like, so much packed into there. But Mark is setting the stage. He's like, this is all of what it's going to be about. The good news of the kingdom and how Jesus is going to come. He's going to die and he's going to raise again. And how he's fulfilling all of the stuff that's going on. And he rules and reigns. And so, you know, through Mark 1 through Mark 8, they're going to go to and fro. You know, they're going to, like, go over Galilee, and they're going back and forth. And there's no, like, real direction that they have so far. Jesus is healing, and he has some followers, and he, you know, does some miracles. And it's kind of like, it's sort of chaotic, but following this opening, Jesus, he is baptized. And so not only do you have, like, this whole story that Mark wants you to see, but we have, like, another facet of this story, which is that the Spirit is going to come down on Jesus. He's going to descend, and we're going to get this beautiful picture of the Father, the Spirit, and Jesus all in one place. And the Spirit isn't this, you know, like, it's a dove, and it's beautiful, and it's a beautiful image, but he doesn't just, like, say these nice words and then, like, done. Like, what does the Spirit do? The Spirit leads Jesus into the wilderness, right? It's, like, it's sort of counterintuitive. Like, if I imagine the Spirit coming into my life and saying all these beautiful things, like, what's the first thing I expect him to do? Not lead me into the wilderness. Like, Jesus, the Spirit comes down, and he leads Jesus into the wilderness, and Jesus is tempted. And so not only narratively do all these, you know, different titles for Jesus coming in, but we're getting into this spiritual world where Jesus not only has to come into the authorities of the Jews and to Rome and all of this stuff that's happening in the real world, there is another world, a spiritual world, that Jesus is also confronting, and he's confronting the evil one. And so all of those things are kind of going to come to a head too. And so setting all those things up for us, like Mark 8 is important because all of these sort of parts of the stories are like coming to a climax. And if we don't see Mark in that frame, we're kind of going to see Jesus' words as like harsh. They're not going to make sense to us. He's going to seem like a hard teacher. He's going to seem really confusing. You're going to run into Mark and you're going to read, you know, like whoever would save his life would lose it. And you're just going to sit there and be like, what does this mean? But seeing that this is the pivot point for the whole story, that Jesus needs to reveal himself as a suffering servant and that he invites us into that, it kind of puts a different tone on this, that before we even get to this statement, there is so much going on in the story and so much that Mark has in mind that if we don't see it correctly, we miss the point. It's kind of like if you guys have seen The Prestige, the very opening scene is like all of these birds and hats, and you're just like, you're looking at it and you're like, what is going on? And it's not until like, you know, you get further down into the movie that you understand like what the point of like those birds and hats and the cane and like all of this sort of looks like destruction, like what it means, right? You're like, oh, like the opening makes so much sense. And the same thing with Mark is that if we look at these opening verses and we see that they're setting the story for us, Mark 8 is going to make so much more sense for us. So let's start reading. Mark 8, and we'll just kind of go through it from the first verse, and then we'll kind of make our way to the end of it. So you kind of see where he's coming from. All right. In those days, there was again a large crowd, and they had nothing to eat. He called the disciples and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd because they've already stayed with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. Right? So part one, he has compassion. And it's not like this sort of, oh, like I kind of feel bad for them. Like these guys have been following him for days. Nothing to eat. They're tired. They don't. And the crowds at this point, he's kind of like weeded them out. Like you don't gain a crowd by just them happening upon. The way Mark frames it is this crowd was following him. They are intent on being followers of Jesus. It's not just, they're not just there just because, you know, they're there. And so verse 3, if I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way. And some of them have come a long distance. His disciples answer them, where can anyone get bread here in this desolate place to feed these people? How many loaves do you have? He asked them. 7, they said. He commanded the crowd to sit down on the ground. Taking the 7 loaves, he gave thanks, broke them, and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. So they served them to the crowd. They also had a few small fish, and after he had blessed them, he said these were to be served as well. They ate and were satisfied. Then they collected 7 large baskets of leftover pieces. About 4,000 were there. He dismissed them. And he immediately got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. And so this part, the beginning part of the book, or I'm sorry, of the chapter, is we're like set into another weird story. So this is the 4,000, not to be confused with the 5,000 story. And part of the importance of opening up with this is, one, is there's this sort of scene where there's like people and there's this crowd and they're coming from all different sorts of places. And I believe it's, I'm getting the names of some of these places mixed up. But they're coming from everywhere. And what Jesus is doing is he's going to tie this story about fish and bread, and he's going to tie that to the Pharisees. And then he's going to tie the Pharisees' story and like how there's like this unleavened bread. He's going to tie that into this blind man story. And then he's going to tie the blind man story into how we do not see Jesus as we're supposed to. And then he's going to finally get to the end and like tell him what it means to be the Messiah. And so the feeding of the 4,000 is important because these guys don't understand what's going on. They don't understand why is this bread important and why is this fish important and like, why are we here and why are we doing this? And it's also kind of confusing because if you were the disciples, you would assume that because they have already been a part of the 5,000 story when Jesus feeds the 5,000. And so you're kind of looking at this verse like, why is this in here? And why are the disciples still confused? Like, shouldn't it click for them already? Shouldn't they understand who Jesus is? And Mark, part of what he's getting at is like, no, like the disciples don't fully understand what's going on. They don't get it. They don't see that Jesus is the Messiah. They don't see what this means for the world and what it means for them. And they're still like really confused. And it kind of like can boggle our mind, right? Like you can see all of these miracles. You can see all of what's going on and you can still like not get it. You can still not see the big picture and what Jesus is doing. And so we're going on. Verse 11. The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, demanding him a sign in heaven to test him. Sighing deeply in his spirit, he groans. He says, why does this generation demand a sign? Truly, I tell you, no sign will be given to this generation. Then he left them, got back into the boat, and went to the other side. The disciples had forgotten to take bread and had only one loaf with them in the boat. Then he gave them strict orders. Watch out. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. They were discussing among themselves that they did not have any bread. Aware of this, he said to them, why are you discussing the fact you have no bread? Do you understand or comprehend? Do you have hardened hearts? Do you have eyes and not see? Do you have ears and not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of leftovers did you collect? 12, they told him. When I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many baskets full of pieces did you collect? 7, they said. And he said to them, don't you understand yet? They came back to Bethsaida. Okay, so it ends there, right? And so you kind of get to see what's going on here. So this 4,000 people, it's not just there just to be like another miracle. Jesus is giving us insight that like these disciples still don't understand what's going on. He's like, do you not see? Do you not comprehend? Right? And in some sense, like I think what Mark is doing is not only is he painting a picture of what the disciples look like, but he's kind of painting a picture of what we look like sometimes, right? We look over the word and we see all of these stories and we see how these point to God and we see these promises, and yet like it doesn't click. Like, do you not see? Do you not understand? Do you not see what's going on throughout the entire Bible? Do you not see how this is pointing to Jesus? And the idea and theme of sight is moved forward. And so this is where it's helpful to know the Mark style of like putting a sandwich together, because he's telling the story about the disciples and what's going on. And then like it almost seems random, but there's this story of the blind man. They came to Bethsaida. They brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and brought him out of the village, spitting on his eyes and laying his hands on him as he asked him, do you see anything? He looked up and said, I see people. They look like trees walking. Again, Jesus placed his hand on the man's eyes. The man looked intently and his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Then he sent him home saying, don't even go into the village. What's funny is this is the only place in the Gospels that Jesus has to perform a healing twice. And because other times, right, he like says, hey, walk, and they start walking. But for some instance, in this particular story, Jesus has to lay his hands on him twice. And what Mark's doing here is tying the whole story together, because he's saying that what's happening is we as followers of Jesus Sometimes when we look at Jesus, we see trees walking. We see the world around us and we don't see clearly. We're confused. We're like, what's going on? And all of this is so confusing. I don't get it. Like, I thought, Jesus, I thought you loved me. And I thought that my life was going to be good. And I thought that you're supposed to rule and reign. And like, why is life so hard? And why is it all so confusing? Like, what's going on? And part of what Mark is doing here is he's saying, or Jesus is saying, that seeing Jesus as he truly is a, in some ways, a two-step process. We see Jesus as the Messiah, and we see him as a good king, and we see what he's about, but we don't get the full picture. Like, we start to see Jesus as he truly is when we follow him, when we take up our cross, when we deny ourselves. Seeing Jesus is, in some ways, a two-step process. So let's keep reading. Jesus went out with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the road, he asked his disciples, who do people say I am? They answered him, John the Baptist, others Elijah, still others one of the prophets. But you, he asked them, who do you say I am? Peter answered him, you are the Messiah. And he strictly warned them to tell no one about him. Then he began to teach them that it was necessary for the Son of Man to suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chiefs, priests, and scribes, be killed, and rise after 3 days. He spoke openly about this. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning around and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, get behind me, Satan. You are not thinking about God's concerns, but human concerns. And in Greek, the word rebuke is like not just like, oh, like, Peter, please stop, you know, like, you really shouldn't say that. The word is similar to the wilderness story when Jesus rebukes Satan and doesn't give in to what Satan wants. It's like it's really, really, really strong. And so not only are we getting an image of what it means to be the Messiah, but we're getting an image of what else is going in the story, that there is a spiritual realm, that Jesus is not only here to forgive people and lay his life down for people, but he's here to defeat the evil one, right? There is another battle that's going on, and we get to choose what part of the story we're going to be on. We're going to be a part of the side that Jesus is on, where he's going to reign and rule, and he's going to give his life for people, and these people are going to trust him, or we get to be on the other side, where we don't trust him, and where we give in to Satan, and we're led by him, and this life is portrayed in two sides. And so we get this image of Peter and what's going on here. And then verse 34, calling the crowd along with his disciples, he said to them, if anybody wants to follow after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life because of me and the gospel will save it. For what does it benefit someone to gain the whole world and yet lose his life? What can anyone give in exchange for his life? Whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. And so, part of the reason why I wanted to read all of Mark is because these stories are like, they're connectors. It's constantly connecting, 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 and then Jesus is able to speak. And I think for some of us, we kind of view these words with Jesus as like speed limits. So as a civil engineer, I took a lot of different classes, one of them being transportation, which was probably my least favorite. It was kind of boring. But something that you have to learn in engineering is all these roads have different curves on them. And, you know, the wider the curve, the slower you should go. And then the skinnier the curve, the faster you can go. And it seems pretty intuitive. But, like, speed limits, you guys, are good. They are really good for us. And I think some of us view speed limits as suggestions. Like, oh, wow, like 45. Nice. It's dark. I wonder if I can get away with 55. And so Jason, so I'm coming to church this morning, and I see Jason and Elena. They're going at the same time, and we get to the corner at McClintock and Baseline. And we roll our windows down, we say hi to each other, and we're like about to turn left, and we're driving recklessly, put it simply. We're taking this curve really, really hard, and I'm like, my foot is like down as far as it can go, and like I'm trying to be Jason, and then at 5 seconds in, I'm like, oh gosh, what am I doing? I'm going to be talking about speed limits, and I'm clearly going faster than the speed limit. I really need to slow down and stop. And I think for most of us, yes, speed limits are this really, really weird thing where we know we should probably abide by them, and we know that they're good. And me as an engineer, I'm like, yes, they're good. They're meant to keep you safe. But we see them as recommendations, and we don't see them as authority, right? And I think what Jesus, with Jesus's words sometimes, we can dance around them. We're like, oh, did Jesus really say that? Did Jesus, is this a recommendation? Is this a speed limit? Are the aircrafts really following us? You know, we don't view his words as authoritative, and we question him. We say, did Jesus mean what he actually said? Or did he mean something else? And we kind of wrestle with this, and we're like, well, there's all of these verses that Paul said, and so therefore I'm going to almost disregard Jesus' words, or I'm going to soften the blow. And so we get to these verses, and we're like, these are strong. And for some of us, if we read these verses and we're uncomfortable, that's good. If you read these verses and you aren't uncomfortable, and you're like, I've heard this 1,000 times, nice, Jesus, let's keep going. These words are supposed to ruffle your feathers. They're supposed to make you stop and consider, did Jesus mean what he say? And how are we supposed to approach these words? And it's fitting as we're as a church, some of us are walking through perspectives, and we're thinking about evangelism, and we're trying to consider this whole new year, whatever that means for us. And I think as a church, we come to these verses, and we're like, Jesus, what do you have for us? Did you mean what you say? And is there something in this for me? And so we'll take this. I think part of how we get insight into what Jesus is saying is understanding that the Bible is beautiful because it leads to Jesus, and it's about his life and about the death and resurrection. And Jesus isn't saying this to be harsh. He isn't saying this so we can, try harder, just be better and grit your teeth and do more. It's when he talks about the cross and picking it up, it's not this symbol of there's all of this, celebrities, will wear a cross. Or when I first became a Christian, I thought the cross was I have to bury, this burden on me. I'm a Christian, and carrying my cross means to carry all of these hard burdens and then just follow Jesus. In the first century, that's not what it meant. To carry your cross meant death. And so what Jesus is saying is, if anyone would follow me, he must deny himself. All of our desires and our passions, he must consider those and forego them. That to follow him means to carry our cross. It means the cross means shame, it means suffering, and it means death. That when we consider following Jesus and being like him, he wants us to really examine, what does this mean? And if you guys are familiar with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, says, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. And I think if we look at the text, it's pretty simple. But Christ isn't, when he says to follow him, it's not this, you know, like, oh, you know, it's going to be good and it's going to be easy. And, you know, you're going to have the time of your life. Like, come on me. Like, he sees this whole sea of people and his disciples there. And he chooses to say, if you want to follow me and be like me, you're going to die. Point blank. That's what's going to happen. And you're going to have to deny yourself, right? And he rephrases this. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life because of me and the gospel will save it. And then if you're like, you're thinking about the speed limit, you're like, is that true? Like, I thought, you know, this Christian life was about, you know, I pray this prayer and it's easy and like I go forward with my life. Or, you know, like, yeah, God is here and this is my life and I can follow him whenever I choose to and this is all good. Like, and we start like getting, we start putting other verses on top of it. Like, is this a work? Is it not work? Like, what does it have to do with salvation? And we can like overcomplicate this, but it's simple. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life because of me and the gospel will save it. And you're like, okay, like, so what does life mean? You know, like, you're kind of asking these questions, and you're like, all right, well, what does he mean by life? Is it like a physical life? Is it eternal life? And he clarifies it. For what does it benefit someone to gain the whole world yet lose his life? Or in some of the versions, it says lose your soul. Like, what good does it do you if you gain all of what you wanted in this life and you lost yourself? Like, what good is that, right? And so we get, like, on one hand, these words are really challenging for his disciples and they're challenging for us, but in some sense, they're the most liberating words we could hear because he's being honest. He says, if you want to follow me and you want life, lose it. Lose it. Give it up. Don't hold tightly onto all of these things. Lose it. Because in losing your life and giving it up for my sake, you keep it. And so your next question is like, well, did Paul think this? Does Paul have the same mindset? Like, if there's anyone we can look to and say like, well, like, Paul kind of clarifies some of Jesus' teachings for us, then maybe we get some insight into what's going on with Paul. So let's look at 2 Corinthians 4. 2 Corinthians 4. Okay. Therefore, since we have this ministry, because we were shown mercy, we do not give up. Instead, we have renounced the secret and shameful things, not acting deceitfully or distorting the word of God, but commending ourselves before God to everyone's conscience by an open display of the truth. But if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this age has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For we are not proclaiming ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as servants for Jesus' sake, right? For Jesus' sake. For God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shown in our hearts to give light of the knowledge of God's glory in the face of Jesus Christ. He kind of like brings it home here. Now we have this treasure in jars of clay, in clay jars, so that this extraordinary power may be from God and not from us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. We are persecuted, but not abandoned. We are struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry the death of Jesus in our body, so that the life of Jesus may also be displayed in our body. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that Jesus' life may also be displayed in our mortal flesh. So then death is at work in us, but life in you. And so since we have the same spirit of faith in keeping with what is written, I believe, therefore I spoke. We also believe and therefore speak. And then he keeps going on. Like, do you see it? He says, for we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake. What does Jesus say? Right? He says, if you want to save your life, you will lose it. And those who lose it for my sake and the gospel will keep it, right? What Jesus is saying is not opposed in any sort of way to how Paul lived his life. Paul clearly saw in all that he did that his life is lived for Jesus' sake, and his life is lived for the gospel's sake. And so what happens if we choose to keep it? We don't have time to read all of it, but there's a story in The Great Divorce. And there's a ton of stories, actually. But one in particular is this mother who loses her son. And so her brother, who is like a physical being, and the mother who's not physical. If you read it, it'll make more sense. But basically, there's shadow people and there's real people. And they're having this conversation. And the mother is like, I lost my son. All I want to do is see my son. I loved him. I gave my life for him. Like, why would a good and loving God take away my son? I clearly loved him. Like, why is this happening? And as you move forward in the story, you see that what C.S. Lewis is getting at is the mother loved her son and only her son. That the mother was obsessed with her son. And once you, like, the line between love and obsession is, like, really close sometimes, right? Because after a while, your loves just, they consume you, right? Part of what Jesus is saying is if you try to save your life, you'll lose it, is, like, all of these things that we hold so close to us, they become idols. Like, we stop worshiping God and we stop looking to him and loving him. And soon, like, all of these things, they consume our hearts and they take us away from Jesus. And we stop consuming them and these things start consuming us, right? Like, the losing your life is going to happen in the end, but it's also slowly happening now, right? Where all of these desires and things that you hold so tightly, they're going to destroy you. And they're going to keep ripping you away from Jesus. And so where do we go from here? Like, we're kind of trying to focus in on these verses. And if these verses are good, and Paul says they're good, where does that leave us? I used to get frustrated with people who talk about C.S. Lewis all the time. I was like, do you follow Jesus or do you follow C.S. Lewis? And I would be like so frustrated, like, why do these people quote him all the time? And like, where's Jesus in all this? And as we close and as like we're forced to engage with this question, if you try to save your life, you will lose it. If you lose your life for my sake and the gospel, you will save it, right? My sake, Jesus' sake, meaning that we love people and we love God, right? We do things for him and for the sake of the gospel. We live so that the good news of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection will be proclaimed to the world. That's what it means to embody this verse. We love people, we love God, and we preach the good news in our life and in our death. And that's what it means to embody this verse. And if we seek comfort and we seek security, and we seek our own glory, and in so many capacities our lives are not looking anything like Jesus, then I'm pretty sure we're saving our lives. And so as we consider these words of Jesus, we're faced with a choice. We can lose our life for his sake and the gospel, and we can deny ourselves and we could take up our cross, or we can save it. And for those people who choose to save it, on the last day, he says, like, why were you ashamed of me? Right? Ashamed of his words, ashamed of the good news of Jesus. Right? And they exchange the glory of God for their own glory. And so, if these words are hard, like, that's okay because they are. And if it causes us to be uncomfortable, like, that's okay, because I think in part Jesus said these words to make us feel uncomfortable. But with all of this said, I think as believers, we have like We have a beautiful picture of who Jesus is, right? Who loved himself and gave himself for the world. Like, there's a sense in which we look at these words and we should be encouraged by them because he loves us, because we see the whole picture, because we see that glorifying God and living for him is good, and that's the best good for this world, and that's what's best for us. I forget who said this, but if you love yourself, there is danger of it being destroyed. Therefore, you may not love it, since you do not want it to be destroyed. But, and not wanting it to be destroyed, you love it. And it's circular, right? It's like Jesus, as a good savior, as a friend, as a brother, gives us these words as warning. And he has our best interest in mind. He looks at these followers with compassion and love, and he says, if you lose your life for my sake and the gospel, you will save it. This is good. Like, it's good that he warns us. It's good that he kind of lays out what's going to happen for us so we're not surprised. And it's also good because this is right before he's going to go to the cross and he's going to do what we couldn't do, that he will suffer and die and rise 3 days later. And so as we close, I'm going to read, it's from Mere Christianity. And he says this in a lot of ways that I could never say. So I'll proceed. The same principle holds, you know, for more everyday matters, even in social life. You will never make a good impression on other people until you stop thinking of what sort of impression you are making. Even in literature and art, no man who bothers about originality will ever be original. Whereas if you simply try to tell the truth without caring two pence how often it has been told before, you will, 9 times out of 10, become original without ever having noticed. The principle runs through all of life from top to bottom. Give up yourself and you will find your real self. Lose your life and you will save it. Submit to death of your ambitions and favorite wishes, every day and death of your whole body in the end. Submit with every fiber of your being and you will find eternal life. Keep nothing back. Nothing that you have not given away will be really yours. Nothing in you has not died will ever be raised from the dead. Look for yourself and you will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. But look for Christ and you will find him. And with him, everything else thrown in. And so, I don't know where we all are coming from. Some of us had, you know, maybe a crazy week. Some of us had a not so crazy week. You know, like with kids, and like there's so many questions that are circling our heads. And the Sunday gathering is really beautiful because we just get to take a small piece out of our week and we get to meditate on the words of Jesus. And as we close, I think Paul, like C.S. Lewis, puts a lot of things better than I could ever. And Galatians 2:20 is, I feel like, a verse that has been really dear to my heart for a ton of reasons, but I think it's like, it's Paul gets it. Paul gets these words, and he sees these words as beautiful in a way in which I think we ought to see them as beautiful, right? I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live, I live by death. Or the life I now live, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me, right? It's like we have been crucified, we have died. It is no longer us who lives, but the Spirit is dwelling in us and living in us. And this whole life we're going through, we're just trusting Jesus. We're following him and we're trusting our good shepherd, right? And we're trusting him, why? Because Jesus loved us and gave himself for us. And he is good and he has our good in interest. And he demonstrates that he loves us by going to the cross. And so he invites us to follow him, to die, and continue to pursue suffering and all of these things for his sake. Why? Because he loves us. He sees the end, and he says, lose your life, right? And in losing your life for my sake, you will save it. And so with that, I'll pray, and we're going to have some announcements, and then also we're going to have Teresa share some of, she went to See the Smiths. So she's going to share some of that. And then we're going to do some prayer and praise requests from Lynn and Philip and then the Smiths as well. I was supposed to go shorter, but sorry. all right. Father, Lord, thank you for sending your son for us, Lord. Thank you for giving us these words and thank you for warning us. Thank you for, man, proclaiming victory. Jesus, thank you for obeying. Thank you for giving us these words as a warning and so that we can find true life. Lord, may we see these words as not just a speed limit, Lord, but may we take heed of these words. And may we look to you as the author and perfecter of our faith, the one who loved us and gave himself for us, Lord. In your name I pray. Amen.